Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello. A very warm welcome into Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. This is our opportunity as a community to come together and explore and learn about the world of technology, whether that be accessible or otherwise. We're always keen to hear from you. Voice notes and emails, very welcome. TechTalk at rnib.org.uk. That's TechTalk at rnib.org.uk. UK. Coming up this week, we will be speaking with Google. Christopher Patnow is Google's Accessibility and Disability Inclusion Lead for Europe, the Middle East and Africa. We'll also learn about a NaviLens trial in Wolverhampton, and we'll be speaking with Caroline Casey from the Valuable 500. So stay tuned. We've got a packed show for you this time. It's Tech Talk. Welcome in to my co-host this week, Callum Stoneman. Hello, sir. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks. It's a busy one this week, isn't it?
It is. It is. What's grabbing your attention? What's in your technology in tray this week, Callum?
Well, speaking of Google, we had an announcement from them recently about updates to Google Lookout. So Lookout is, I guess, Google's equivalent of Seeing AI. It's available on Android, and it can do all sorts of features, you know, document and text recognition and product recognition and all that kind of stuff. And they've just announced a new feature on there for captioning images. So if you've got an image that doesn't have alt text and doesn't have a description, you can take that image, put it into Lookout, and then ask questions on it. We've seen this with Be My Eyes, with their virtual volunteer, and we heard this from Envision at CSUN as well. And I guess this is Google's take on it. It says it's rolling out to a selected group of users. I'm not entirely sure what that means and how you get access to it, but I will be digging out my Android device and having a look into this.
I think it's fair to say all these things are sort of in testing at the moment. They're not all available to everyone at this moment in time, which can be a little bit frustrating if you're on the waiting list and you're eager to get testing, you know, with the virtual volunteer or the new version of Lookout when that becomes available later this year. Of course, there was the announcement from Apple as well about point and speak, this idea that you'll be able to point at something that your camera can see, you know, so identifying and controls on an appliance, for example, I think was one of the things that Apple were talking about. Are you looking forward to trying that?
Yeah, I can't wait. We think we haven't got definite release dates for things like that, but it's looking likely to be iOS 17 or the next major iOS release. And that's on devices with LiDAR as well, which is an issue for some. If you've got something like the SE, which I know is a popular model in the blindness community, then you won't have access to this. But I've got a device with LiDAR, so I will be trying this out when I get the chance as well. It's an interesting use case. I just hope that LiDAR starts to kind of trickle down into some of the more budget-friendly options with all these accessibility features coming with it, rather than it just being the pros.
Well, let us know what you think, share what you know, and we will too. Callum Stoneman, thanks very much. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk.
We're fast approaching RNIB's Inclusive Design for Sustainability conference coming up in Glasgow, and Dave spoke with one of the keynote speakers of the event.
It's always exciting to hear about big technology companies and their commitment to accessibility. Well, Christopher Patnow is Google's head of Accessibility and Disability Inclusion for Europe, the Middle East and Africa. Christopher will be a keynote speaker at the Inclusive Design for Sustainability Conference hosted by RNIB Scotland on the 21st and 22nd of June. Christopher joins me now to talk about Google's commitment to accessibility, the Google Assistant, Lookout, and much more besides. Welcome to RNIB Connect Radio, Christopher. For those unfamiliar with your work, just tell us a bit more about your role at Google.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in Connect. This is an honor of mine. My name is Christopher, and I essentially, I lead accessibility and disability inclusion for Europe, Middle East, and in Africa. My job is to try to understand the needs of people with disabilities across this region, from Helsinki to Johannesburg, from Riyadh to Dublin, and to bring these insights into Google so we can make our products, platforms, and services more accessible for everyone. And we do this by building up relationships with organizations like the RNIB, people on the ground, universities, and governments, and take this information, share what we have, and then together, hopefully, build products that are more accessible, more usable for more people.
And you are London-based now. Listening to you, people could think you were from California, which you are, but you have been London-based for the last little while, and you have overseen the development and the opening of the Accessibility Discovery Centre at Google in King's Cross, and you are coming to Scotland to speak at the Inclusive Design for Sustainability conference. Why do you think it's so important for companies like Google to engage in conferences like Inclusive Design for Sustainability?
Our mission statement is to make the world's information universally accessible and useful. And you could only do that by understanding what does it take to make things both accessible and useful. And if a thought process of inclusive design is a wonderful way, if not the best way, to go about doing this. You participate with, you design with, you build with, never for. So by bringing people together, by coming into conferences, by having meetings, having coffee in the hallway, you never know what the next great idea is going to come from. Some of my favorite technologies, my favorite toys, so to say, come from these hallway conversations that happen at conferences. The presentations are a chance for you to meet experts in a field, talk about really exciting things, and then you get to talk about it more afterwards. So these participation in these conferences are important for me to learn about the needs and opportunities, but also hopefully an opportunity for me to share about what we're doing, and then we can figure out together how to make them better.
Well, we're very much looking forward to hearing you speak in Glasgow, Christopher. We've heard some exciting announcements about Bard and generative AI from Google in recent weeks. What do you think this all means for our blind and partially sighted listeners?
I think what it means is we're at day one of a new way of interacting and creating information. For example, we recently announced this new visual QA function that we tested with you here in the ADC, where we're using new AI models to understand content and give you a chance to sort of picture itself a question: what is this? What is that? What do you have in here? And these interactions are groundbreaking. In the past, for example, if you were to have an old-fashioned AI analyze a picture, it would say, "It seems like there are three people jumping." And now you could ask questions: are they happy? What are they doing? What's going around on around them? So this ability to interpret and interact with information is truly unique, and it's just the beginning. I'm really excited to see what'll happen when these data sources become smaller, these models, they become smaller, and we can pipeline them together to create even more different and exciting interactions. That's what gets me up in the morning because it is so much fun.
Google Lookout is an Android-based visual interpreter for blind and partially sighted people. What do you think is its kind of unique selling point?
The fact that you can use a live camera and have it interact with the things that are around you, and it recognizes situations like when it's dark. So say, for example, this is probably a bigger deal in the US than here in the UK because all the banknotes are the same size. But if you're looking to see what money you have, we'll even turn the torch on for you if you're in a dark room, because as someone who is blind, you might not notice that the light isn't on. It would be difficult for a camera, for example, to be able to determine what these things are. But the app itself is reasonably smart, and it recognizes the fact that it needs more light to be able to do the things it needs to do, so it turns it on. And because it's a live interaction, you can take a handful of notes or business cards and just show it. It'll read it to you, show it, read it to you, show it, read it to you. You don't need to take a picture and send it to the AI for a business card or a menu. These things happen in real time. And we took the effort to collaborate with the community to understand what does it mean to have a live view stream? How can we make the algorithm better to understand something that's moving? Because we might, because someone who's blind uses a camera very differently than someone who's not. And that was one of the early lessons we had to learn, is how do you stitch together the images in a thoughtful enough way that we're not forcing anyone to do anything unnatural, but still provide enough guidance to give us enough information so we can give them the results that they're looking for.
At Google, you've got a really diverse mix of hardware, software, and services that you kind of offer. How do you set about, what are the challenges when you're trying to promote inclusive design across such a broad portfolio?
Learning where to focus is the biggest challenge. There's so much that a company like Google can do and help so many people, but do you do a little bit for everybody or do you go deeper for some people? And that's really the question. And if you want to really push the envelope, you need to focus your resources and go deeper. If you want to help everybody a little bit, you can sprinkle accessibility pixie dust on everything, but it doesn't necess that may not necessarily be the right decision. So having this balance of helping everyone versus helping some more deeply is hard because there's no right answer. Everybody deserves help, and we have opportunities to help everyone, but we want to do it well and we want to do it thoughtfully. That's what we're about, to make information and the world's information more accessible, to make things more helpful. It's only helpful if it's rich enough to provide the tools and data that you need.
And one way in which you do that is, of course, through the Google Assistant. And we often hear at RNIB about the extent to which blind and partially sighted people really appreciate their smart speakers, such as the Google Home, and accessing information using voice like the Google Assistant. Are you able to speak to that a little bit? What is Google's commitment to that voice assistant?
We're absolutely committed to doing that. We've learned so much in trying to understand how to interact with people in a natural way. You don't have to go to a Google Assistant and say, "Okay, G, turn on the light." You want it, you could say it in many different ways. You don't have to memorize its way of talking. So that kind of natural human interaction is really important. And I think it'll really help as we move forward for these new generative AI techniques. Having a more robust natural human language allows us to use this the way we want to do it, the way we think. But what's really cool is there's also a branch of technology where people who have non-typical speech patterns can also be served by it if the assistant can understand you. So in conjunction with Microsoft and Meta and Apple and Amazon, we collaborate on what's called the Accessible Speech Project to try to help make all of these voice models more robust. And it allows people, once this really starts taking off, everyone's voice models will be more easily understood. More of these voice models will be able to understand more people. And the assistant is only good as its ability to understand. So if we can make these assistants understand more people, whether you speak Welsh or Scottish or Californian, if you can't be understood, these technologies can't help you. The more we can make them understood, say you have if you have MND or you have some other thing that makes it harder for these technologies to understand you, they become less useful. So by partnering with other organizations like Microsoft and Apple, et cetera, we can make these technologies good for everybody, not just for Google, because we're all about trying to help the same groups of people. We just want to do everything that we can to make sure they use ours because we want to have the best experience. It's better to help everyone first.
With Google, you're providing platforms such as Android, Chrome OS, the YouTube, I suppose, to a certain extent, and the voice assistant, on which developers and content creators can produce their own thing. What would you say to an aspiring developer or content creator who wants to do the right thing and build in accessibility from the get-go? What's a good place to start, do you think?
The best place to start is by starting. There could be, and I've seen the situation where the sort of analysis paralysis. There's so many things that can be done. I don't know where to get started. So the most important thing is actually just to get started. So start with one person's issue, or start with one set of features that you think could be helpful, or start with fixing one bug. The most important thing is that you just get started. When it comes to creating content, there's some very simple things that you can do to make it more accessible. You can make sure that your content has captions, for example, for people who are deaf or hard of hearing, or frankly, just sitting in the tube and wanting to participate in a podcast. There's audio description. You can create audio described versions of the videos that you have. When it comes to textual content, please make sure that you have labels and alt tags, and just spend a little bit of time. And it's none of this is technically hard. The biggest challenge is just remembering to do it because the tool chain doesn't enforce it in ways that we would want it to. But the most important thing is to get started. And then once you get good at it, then you get to start doing the fun stuff. The reason I got engaged in accessibility because I recognized the interesting design challenge and the interesting engineering challenge when you started doing some of these really neat interactive experiences. And that is what kept me here because it's such a rich, broad set of things that we get to work with and gets to solve. It's really a lot of fun. It doesn't have to be difficult when you get started. And the deeper you get, the richer your skill set becomes. Then you get to do the more fun engineering, more fun design things.
And do you have specific tooling for developers wanting to make accessible apps and experiences?
Absolutely. On web, the Chrome Lighthouse, which has an excellent set of tools that allows someone to take a web page or a web experience, and we can provide recommendations on things that you can do. Now, and we have also an equivalent on Android, for example. We have the accessibility scanner. We also have some great functions built into the Android developer tools as well. So we can try to hit you, we can not hit you, we can try to identify situations in real time or in near real time so you can solve them before you actually build your app. So we have tools to make it easy to develop web things. What I was thinking about where the tool chain doesn't exist is, for example, Twitter or Facebook or Mastodon, they don't make it as easy as they could to put in alt text, for example. There's not a lot of reminders to put in captions, or unfortunately, we're in a situation now where captions is becoming more arts than useful. So this might not be as big a deal for the blind and vision audience, but the captions are becoming very, very busy and actually not as useful if you need to use them. So the technologies themselves are evolving in ways, and they can be made better, they can be made more useful. The tools exist to help you. The content space is a little bit harder.
The TalkBack screen reader and, of course, the Lookout visual interpreter on Android increasingly are attempting to describe images that are on screen. And, of course, we're seeing a lot of work in the area of computer vision. Where do you think that's headed? How much will that impact blind and partially sighted people?
This is Christopher the nerd talking. This isn't necessarily Google. Just for the record, in terms of this answer, I spent a lot of time outside of Google working in virtual reality and augmented reality. And I think the potential here is huge because with augmented reality glasses, you have the ability to have cameras on your head, so you don't need to hold your phone out and have it be a risk. There's no risk of it being knocked, no risk of it being stolen. So if we can get to a point where glasses are small enough, the battery life is good enough, you can have the cameras on your head, and we can describe the world around you with great precision. But the interesting question is, what do you describe in a world that was not designed to be read aloud? I mean, there's no accessibility tree for a screen reader to read in the real world. So for me, that's what's really interesting about virtual reality. Virtual reality is a place where we can experiment actively on how to describe a virtual world, virtual three-dimensional world, someone who's blind. So, like a real world screen reader. And then we get to experiment with what happens when you move and the world around you doesn't. Or conversely, if things around you change and you haven't moved, what gets spoken? What gets verbalized? How much is not enough? How much is too much? So then we get to have this really neat situation where computer vision will read us the world and tell us what's there in a way that's relevant to us. For example, if you're an avid birder, again, I'm making this up completely, but you can say, I don't care if there's a really cool bird, tell me about it. And another person who doesn't care about birds will never want to hear that. So with AI and computer vision, we have the ability to have a customized view of the world here to us. It boggles the mind, and I can't wait to do my little parts to help invent that world.
Well, Christopher, thank you so much for your time and for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio. We're looking forward to hearing you speak at the Inclusive Design for Sustainability Conference on the 21st and 22nd of June from Glasgow. Before I let you go, what's the best way for listeners to stay up to date with the latest work on accessibility from Google?
Yeah, we actually have a quarterly newsletter that we share all of the latest updates and cool things that we find. You can sign up to that at g.co/a11y/news. That's g.co/a11y/news. Dave, thank you for the chance to sit and join you, and I look forward to raising a pint with you out in Scotland.
Christopher Patno from Google, thanks very much.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Amidst the celebrations from this year's Global Accessibility Awareness Day, Dave sat down with Caroline Casey from the Valuable 500 organization.
On Global Accessibility Awareness Day, we talk a lot about how organizations can be more accessible and more inclusive. And someone who is working really hard in this field is Caroline Casey from the Valuable 500. Welcome to RNIB Connect Radio, Caroline. Can you just help our listeners understand who you are and what the objectives of the Valuable 500 are?
Well, I'm a troublemaker for starters. I'm
Well, we know this,
Irish and I'm a
Caroline.
troublemaker. I'm 51 years old. I have been working as a disability activist and campaigner and social entrepreneur. I think they're all the titles they throw at me. Year 2000, when I came out of the disability closet, I was working as a management consultant with Accenture. And I had not disclosed that I had a vision impairment. I have ocular albinism, and I'm registered legally blind here in Ireland. But I had not disclosed to my employer at the time when I was 28 years old. So when I kind of tumbled out of the disability closet, it kind of was a very life-changing moment for me. Because not only did I, have to take responsibility for my own vision and how I was going to live with that and accept it and not fight it, but also I became aware of the level of discrimination and exclusion and marginalization of the global disability community to which I am part of, and also to the extraordinary idea that we have so many people in the world with avoidable sight loss because they don't have access to eye health and eye care. And so when I kind of started to learn about that, I was like, what? And I'm the daughter of an entrepreneur, and I think entrepreneurs by our nature have a tendency when they see a problem, they want to fix it. So yeah, I just I, it's kind of that inflection point in my life where I decided I want to be part of a solution. And my belief from the very, very beginning has always been if we want to end exclusion in the world, we have to have business meaningfully, intentionally at the table, fully accountable for the power that they hold in the world. They're the most powerful force on this planet, and what business includes and makes accessible and values, society will follow. And that has been my absolute belief for the last 23 years. But the Valuable 500 was born because of my sheer frustration that change wasn't accelerating fast enough. And if we want to create inclusive business, we need inclusive leaders. And I had never really heard a CEO of a business stand up and speak about their accountability and commitment to integrating disability into their business. And I was fed up. So as far as I was concerned, I wanted to break the CEO silence. And to me, it's not enough to have one CEO be brilliant. I mean, it's fantastic to have Satya Nadella of Microsoft, but you can't, this problem is so large. And if you want to change the business system, you need a mass. And so I thought 500, well, why not? That's what I did. So I went off to try and find 500 companies with 500 CEOs who were willing to work with us in a partnership to drive system change and be accountable and not just tick box and have days or, you know, PR campaigns or whatever. No, I mean, really seriously do the hard work of system change.
So what do you believe then, Caroline, has been the Valuable 500's greatest achievement to date?
The greatest achievement is that we did it. You know, I will say this, we are the second biggest business partnership in the world after UN Global Compact. And like, to give you some sense of that, you know, we built it in 2 years and 3 months. We represent some of the biggest names in business, CEOs and brands. We are 64 sectors. We represent 22 million employees, 41 headquartered countries and 23 trillion in market cap. Now, you think about that might and that combined power. That's an extraordinary thing to achieve, to build a partnership like that when nothing like that exists for any other issue in the world. And I think our greatest achievement was I launched it on the main stage of the World Economic Forum when people were rolling their eyes behind me going, who does that Irish woman think she is? Like, the World Economic Forum does not open up its main stage for disability. And I was like, yes, it will. And it was the right stage because it was really centering disability in on the leadership agenda. And then to build this 500 was its first biggest achievement. But the next biggest achievement, with something as stark as building a Valuable 500 with no money, with just grit and resilience, with that opportunity comes huge responsibility. And, you know, what we're talking about on Global Accessibility Awareness Day on the 18th is the next challenge that we're putting to that 500 strong community. It's not enough we just built you. It's not enough that I have 500 signatures of CEOs and 500 leadership commitments. That's not enough. That was your entry point. Now I want you to work with us together. And I want you to tackle some of the biggest system barriers. And I don't want any more excuses. Because if we work in it together, we could do something. But looking at the problem and talking about how it's too hard and too difficult and too complex and legislation, no, I'm not interested. I want us to work together to make the change happen.
Many of us in this community agree that accessibility is absolutely not about a day or a half an hour conversation or a training or whatever. Like, accessibility and inclusion, that they're mindsets, right? That apply equally every day to everyone in every situation. How far have we got to go before the reality of inclusion catches up with the rhetoric?
You know, we could have all the answers, all the technology answers, all the architectural answers for accessibility, but what is stopping us is will and intention and accountability. And the only way that we are going to truly create an accessible and inclusive world for everyone is that we understand there are 8 billion people living on this planet, and this world needs to be designed for every single one of us. And the leaders in positions of government and business and the not-for-profit and the UN need to be held to account, because in the shadow and light of leaders, what leaders do and the choices they make affect the cultures of the organizations, the companies, the governments that we all are operational in. But when people truly understand that by 2030, up to 80% of the wealth of this world is going to be in the hands of 60 to 80 year olds. And as we know, as we get older, our bodies might not work so well. So I wonder, do we follow the money? And when people get older and they have a personal experience of being excluded, they change it. But I don't want to wait until that happens. As far as I'm concerned, accessibility and inclusion is not a passion project. It is not a choice. It is a right. And we need to be measuring our leaders against it.
thank you so much, Caroline, for joining me. I've just one more question before I let you go. I know you've got a busy schedule. Many of your messages are directed at business leaders, at policy makers, at people of influence. But what would you say to our listeners, to the blind and partially sighted people, maybe sitting at home, maybe struggling to get into employment? What message would you leave those folks with?
So I came out of the disability closet in the year 2000 when I wrote to companies to sponsor a piece of work I was doing. At the time, they said, we don't do disability. When I started the Valuable 500, which was in 2017 with a big campaign called Hashtag Valuable, they said, okay, disability is on our agenda, but we don't prioritize it. What I will say today, and even if you're sitting at home and you are so frustrated and it feels incredibly difficult, the world is changing. And if that is it too slow, yes. But what you can do is use your voice, because it is more open, the world, in a way that it ever has been before. Never did we think that we'd see disability on the front cover of Vogue magazine, and where that's an issue of a magazine and we've got 365 days to live in a year. What it is doing is raising the visibility of this global community. And what I encourage everyone to do is personally use your voice in asking the questions. Help people understand our experience, because when we add our voices together, and you think about it, that 1.3 billion people of which we are part of, and the mother and the father, which is 54% of our global economy, it cannot be ignored. There is an inflection point today. It is very different to what it was like 20 years ago. But we each have a responsibility for our own journey of self-acceptance, to hold a pen for our own lives, and also to join the collective of what we are part of, to ensure that this issue is constantly visible, constantly on the leadership agenda, and never forgotten or overlooked again. The world's blind spot cannot be disability. It cannot and shall not stay this way if you use your voice and your experience, because then, as far as I can see it, we could make change happen together.
Caroline Casey from the Valuable 500, thanks for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio. At RNIB, we're working to build a more accessible world for people with sight loss, those of us who are blind or partially sighted. But we can't do this alone. We have to make positive change by partnering and collaborating with other organisations. And one area of active interest is, of course, travel and transport. We've been working with Navilens and Transport for West Midlands to demonstrate how access to a transport hub can benefit everyone. So joining me, we have Denise Thompson from Transport for West Midlands. Hello, Denise.
Hi there.
Darren Mayer from Journeo, who develop integrated transport systems. Hello, Darren.
Hi, Dave.
And Oren McAllister from Navilens. Welcome into you.
Hi, Dave. Thank you.
And finally, John Worsfold, who works with us here at RNIB. Denise, I'm going to come to you first of all. Can you just sort of talk a little bit about the motivation? What brought you to this project, and why is accessibility a priority for Transport for West Midlands?
Oh, yeah. So there's several reasons that we were looking at undertaking this trial. At Transport for West Midlands, we've been delivering solutions for our real-time information for buses that are available to blind and partially sighted users through the React key fob system, which is a fine system that works out at bus stops and shelters across the network. However, in places like bus stations, because the stands for the stops are so close together, unfortunately the way that the key fobs work means that they trigger multiple stands at the same time, which is obviously not a good user experience, can be really confusing for people trying to understand the messaging. So we've been looking at a solution, particularly in enclosed spaces, that would provide a much better user experience for blind and partially sighted people to get the information they need when travelling. And we've tried various different things over the years. We tried sort of Bluetooth technology. But when we heard about NaviLens, we were really excited because it uses the user's own device. It provides a much richer experience, with things we'll come on to in a moment, I'm sure. But the other thing from our perspective is a really good solution for all people travelling, but particularly enhanced for blind and partially sighted people. So we were really excited to undertake this and see what difference it can make.
Darren, tell us a bit about the implementation then. What's happened? What's now in place?
So we've installed a number of NaviLens codes throughout Wolverhampton bus station. There are key decision points along a user's journey. And those codes are connected to NaviLens' back office system. And the user's app knows what the user wants to do and matches the information that is assigned to the code with the user's desired journey. And that really helps them. So they're able to do wayfinding through key areas and key decision points throughout the bus station. And when they get to their bus stand that they are looking to depart from, they can get key departure information as well. So they can get a much richer amount of information than we've seen probably. We've installed a mix of codes in different locations as well, at varying heights. And we've also installed codes to provide feedback as well, so we can capture the user experience of the solution. So we can learn as much as we possibly can from this trial.
Oren, can you just help listeners understand what is NaviLens? What does it do?
Yeah, so basically NaviLens is a new-ish, I think we've been around for about 6 years now, and it's a new labelling and navigation system, which was specially designed for the purpose of helping blind and partially sighted people be more autonomous in unfamiliar surroundings and in different situations. The system involves the use of 2D NaviLens codes and our applications. We have two versions of the applications. The app detects the code quite easily because it is a 2D code and the colors are quite different within the code, that it actually helps us to be able to detect the codes from quite far distances, at extreme angles also, at lightning fast speed, and in all types of light conditions, which is especially beneficial for anyone who's blind or partially sighted, because unless you know where the code is, it's very difficult to find that kind of information. With NaviLens codes, they're much easier to detect and access that information. So initially what happens is the NaviLens app will detect the code, and it'll then tell you where the code is, what it is, and what it is attached to. For example, a bus stop or the entrance to a building, an elevator, or even products. And then it will direct you to within centimeters of the code. It will give you directional information right up until you arrive. And then on arrival, the extra information, the essential information, will then be provided to you automatically. This can be such as Darren mentioned earlier, you know, real-time information and additional information as to what you can do in that particular location. There are two applications. So we have NaviLens, which is basically provides audio information, which is more directed towards people who are blind and partially sighted. And we also have NaviLens Go, which provides information for everyone else. This enables us to be more inclusive. In this feature, in this app, you can put sign language videos, pictograms, easy to read text, even content for children also, if you so wish. And the information is also provided in 37 languages. So it provides a universal service as well.
Okay, I'm gonna bring John in because we've not heard from you yet, John. Do you want to just sort of talk a little bit from an RNIB perspective about this project, about, you know, why we're involved and why NaviLens might, you know, work particularly well for this project?
Sure, thanks, Dave. Yeah, so strategically, RNIB via Insight, we know that travelling and getting around is a major issue for blind and partially sighted people. We've been instrumental in trying to collaborate and instigate change in travel and transport. One thing, it was quite obvious, is we're a sight loss charity trying to instigate change in in an industry that we don't actually partake in. So we were looking for collaborators. So we joined up or collaborated with Journeo about 3 years ago now, Darren, I think it is. And we were looking for a project where we could create some catalytic change. And what better way to do that is in a transport hub that is already being utilized by an authority that actually, as Denise suggested, wants to improve the service for blind and partially sighted people. So that's why we got involved. How we got involved was to basically work with Transport for West Midlands and Journeo to understand what might be a solution that could affect that change. And looking at the environment in Wolverhampton bus station and the fact that it's got tactile paving in the bus station, Navilens was a natural solution, because as Oran has already suggested, you can place codes at strategic points within the environment and derive information. So that was the reason we got involved.
Darren, I'm going to come back to you then. What have we learned so far from the trial?
We've learned a great amount, Dave. So obviously this is, as John said, it was our first implementation. The first opportunity we've had to place the codes in a live environment and see the feedback. It's the smaller things that you don't necessarily expect that are the big things that you have to take into consideration. So one of the main things was the durability of the codes. So we're an intelligent transport specialist. So we put technology systems throughout the UK and beyond for public transport, and that can be anything from real-time departure information to security systems to passenger counting. And so our knowledge of, say, stickers that are needed for the codes is incredibly limited. And so we learned a great deal from both this trial and trials that Navilens have had elsewhere about the types of codes that you need to apply and how you need to apply them. And so they're durable and they remain available for all people to use for extended periods of time. And then, of course, there's always the accuracy of the information as well, because there is no technology system out there that is not dependent on the reliability of the information that's there in the first place. If you're driving information to a user, you need to make sure that the information is correct, because it's very often better to have no information than to have incorrect information.
Denise, you talked earlier about the reasons you selected Navilens, because it was giving you that granularity that perhaps some other technology wasn't. From your perspective, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going really well. Everybody that we've had feedback from can't say highly enough how impressed they are with it as an experience, as a piece of technology. The main thing for us now is just to get as many people down there to try it out and give us that feedback, because we really appreciate it. We want to build a business case to roll this out wider across the West Midlands. We need to understand what we've got right, what maybe we could improve. We need to understand the situations that this type of technology works best in. So, for example, we think it works really well at a bus station like West Bromwich, but we're not quite sure how it might work at other locations, as I mentioned, just at a bus shelter. And so feedback from users is the thing we really need. But in terms of what we've learnt so far, it's all been really positive.
And Denise, I'm going to stay with you, because obviously as an organisation, Transport for West Midlands, you're kind of responsible for, you know, the journey right the way through, from the moment somebody arrives and while they're in transit and then when they disembark. So obviously making, you know, this particular bus station more accessible is a fantastic start. But, you know, what are your thoughts around that entire journey, literally that passenger journey?
Yeah, absolutely. And another part of the trial that is really exciting is it's the first time we've linked any element of wayfinding or a sense of place with the technology, with then getting onto a vehicle. And although that's only at the moment sort of concentrated in the bus station, even just linking those two things, so how do I get to where I need to go and I need to know the information about the bus, is just a massive step forward. And we want to do more of that. As I say, we've got plans to roll this out further, and we want to understand how to do that. How could it be used on the journey? How could it be used when you reach your destination? Linking it up with other projects we've got going, such as Mobility as a Service, which will provide a sort of full user experience in terms of their journey through an app. So we're very keen to take the learning from this project and feed it on into the future.
Excellent. Now, clearly, this project was rooted in accessibility. That's where it all started. Denise, do you see a wider benefit for the community more generally?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one reason that I think it's a really fantastic solution. The two apps that were mentioned there by NaviLens, as any user knows, when they go to somewhere unfamiliar, whether you've got any kind of mobility issues, sight loss, whatever it might be, it can be really hard to navigate those places. And so anything that helps people do that, to give the feeling of assurance on their journey, I'm going where I need to go, it will just make people make those trips by more sustainable means than getting in their cars or having to take taxis or whatever else it might be. So, yeah, absolutely.
Anyone else want to come in on that point about how do we make technology developed for, you know, making an environment more accessible, how we perhaps apply that to the wider community? Anyone else got thoughts on that?
I got some thoughts on that, Dave.
Yes, please, John.
I think just to build on Denise's comment about the impact she's going to have for blind and partially sighted people, it's important also to note that this could be used by anybody else as well. So the apps are available, NaviLens and NaviLens Go. As Oran suggested, NaviLens is aimed at blind and partially sighted people. NaviLens Go provides a more richer graphical user experience. And anybody can walk into Wolverhampton bus station, detect a code, and utilise that information to find a stand or get real-time information. One massive advantage, I guess, which Denise, you'll probably try and realise, is the fact that the information can be translated automatically into the language of the handset. So whilst all the signage and everything is in English, it will automatically be translated into French or German or Spanish or whatever the passenger is or is using, they can then get that information. So really wide benefits right the way across the board. And for us at RNIB, that is really, really important, because if we want to affect change and a sustainable change, we need to have things that can be utilised and provide wider benefit for the general public. Otherwise, there's always going to be a cost benefit for producing something specifically for blind and partially sighted people.
So we all have a vision for accessible travel, but what needs to happen next? What are the next steps? What do we need to happen? Let's go around each of you for a thought on that. Let's come to you first, Denise.
Yeah, we need the feedback from people to go along and try it out in Wolverhampton, please. There's a survey. There's a link to a survey when you're there, and tell us what you think of it. So the more feedback we get, the better we can build a business case to do more of this.
Darren?
Just to reinforce Denise's point, really, any use of public money is always heavily scrutinised. And so the better business case you can build to show that you are able to provide a solution that benefits everyone and has additional benefits for those that have those are partially sighted or have accessibility needs, adds real weight and strength to that business case and enables you to more easily roll it out across a wider area.
Oren, what do you need?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in total agreement there. It's about bringing the awareness out to the general public. And I know I work quite closely with many people who are blind and partially sighted. And I know within the community, there is a very loud voice. There's a very quick link to other groups, to everyone. And it is about bringing about that awareness and getting people out there to actually experience it. It's a common thing, you know, you can describe how the experience is quite easily, but until you've actually tried it and tested it for yourself, I think that's one of the most vital things. It's kind of the proof of the pudding is in the eating type scenario. So that for me is the most important thing, is getting out there, getting the information back and seeing how we can move it on throughout the internal and external communities.
And John, how do we move this on?
I think we move this on by gathering the feedback to prove that this is a solution, that it provides that wider benefit. I think to build on Denise's point earlier on in the conversation about this is a trial at the moment in a transport hub. And when we talk about end-to-end journeys, We've got to make sure that the same solution enables people to get on a bus stop and get off at a bus stop and provide that wider benefit. So it's the wider trial in months to come to prove that this has that sustainable benefit for blind and partially sighted people and other passengers. If blind and partially sighted people want to try this, they can literally rock up to Wolverhampton bus station and using the Navilens apps, they can scan the codes. There's also a code within the bus station that takes them to an online survey, so they can provide feedback about how they found it, and that will inform what we do next as a consortium.
Oren, for those new to Navilens, what's the best place to start?
You know, obviously Navilens, our initial focus was always about transport and travel. That's, as John and everyone has spoken about, it's one of the biggest hurdles for anyone before. But we have branched out into other areas of industry all around. So, I mean, the best thing to do is to download the application, search out Navilens codes in the supermarkets, in your local transport hubs, in all kinds of situations. Go online, go onto our website, learn a little bit more about it. We also have our own YouTube channel. So we have lots of informational videos out there about all of these types of implementations. In many cases, it's mainly about, it's for training purposes and understanding the system more, but there's a lot to be learned from there. So I would say download the applications, test it out, and if anybody can, get down to Wolverhampton as soon as possible. You know, it has to be said, it's one of the fullest implementations that's been done in the UK, and it is really worth experiencing and seeing just how much effort and work has been put in by so many people throughout the project. So that's what I say, get out there, get testing, get the app downloaded and enjoy it, and get Navilens Go downloaded as well, because there's so many other little features that can be used that anybody can benefit from. And also one of the added benefits then as well, Dave, is for anybody who downloads the Navilens app, they also have access to a series of personal codes. These are free codes that you can download within the application. They come into your email, you print them off, and you can use them around your own home. You program these codes yourself for whatever purpose you wish it to be. It can be anything from tea and coffee containers to remote controls, to luggage, to whatever you want. You can use these codes for your own purpose. And once you sign up, you get access to, it's approximately 1,000 of these free codes, and they come in all varying sizes and shapes. So they can be used in varying situations, on food in the freezer. So it's a great access to that help as well.
And your website, Oren?
Yeah, so it's www.navilens.com. And the codes themselves can be downloaded from within the application, and that is by going into the menu section and request Navilens codes, and you have access to all of them there. And in fact, there are also sets of pre-programmed codes that are also available for associations, medical centres and schools, and there will be a new one coming soon for libraries.
Denise Thompson from Transport for West Midlands, Darren Mayer from Journeo, Oren McAllister from Navilens, and John Worsfold from RNIB. Thanks for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio. And thanks very much to our panel there, sharing news of that Navilens trial at Wolverhampton bus station. Callum Stoneman, I know mobility has very much been on your radar recently. Obviously, you were road testing the WeWalk Smart Cane, and you will be taking a keen interest in many of these proposed solutions to improve indoor navigation and mobility. Given that we've got all the some different approaches, you know, the optical codes with Navilens, there's Bluetooth-based solutions, some are using kind of LiDAR mapping. It's all a bit Wild West, isn't it? There's a lot going on, and how do we know what's going to fly or die?
I think just through testing, really, and just through these trials and seeing what works. I mean, they've all got their pros and cons. You know, I guess the main con to all of these is that they require some kind of, or most of these, I should say, they require some sort of infrastructure set up from the organization or the people running the building. And I've said this before, it's difficult enough sometimes to get someone to fix, you know, unlabeled buttons on a website, let alone put this navigation thing in their environments. So I think we've just got to wait and see. And they've always got the added difficulty of that they require a smartphone as well. So, you know, you've got to have a smartphone that's capable of using the apps, or you've got to have a phone with LiDAR for some of these. I quite like the built-in solutions, you know, like, for example, we've got door detection with the Apple devices. And that's, you can sort of just, if you've got the right device, you can sort of just pick that up and go. It doesn't require any input from, you know, the building owners. But it's limited, you know, it's just shouting out what it sees around you. Whereas something like Good Maps or Navilens, they've built in the information about that building that it can tell you. And I guess the other challenge is that you've always got to have your phone out. You know, you've always got to have your phone held in front of you or strapped to some sort of chest harness or something. You've got to have it so that the camera's out pointing. You know, this needs to come to a pair of glasses. I keep saying this. When are the glasses coming that can do this?
Indeed. And you know, skills development is the thing for me, right? Because obviously your core mobility skills, using your white cane, using your guide dog, keeping your ears free to access the people and the environment around you, that is paramount. And it is a real skill to integrate technology into those mobility experiences, I think. Getting that balance right where you're listening to verbal cues or maybe receiving haptic cues from your smartphone or smartwatch, and how do you do that and balance that? And are rehab professionals really teaching that stuff properly? So yeah, lots of work to do, I think.
You're right, it is a skill. I mean, even for me, I see myself as a pretty confident traveller. You know, I was massively confident with Iggy, with my guide dog. I'm getting there now with the cane. You know, I think I'm feeling a bit more of a boost of confidence as I start to use it. But yeah, it is. It can just be massively overwhelming, you know. And that's one of the things that I liked about the WeWalk app when it works, is that you've got several different types of navigation all within one app, whereas, you know, rather than having to kind of get somewhere and then go, right, oh, which one am I using now? Which one works here?
Well, safe travels if you are going out and about. Let us know what technology you are using. That's it, Callum Stoneman. We're almost at the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. Tune in next time when we'll be hearing about some of the first steps that you can take to make your kitchen more accessible and safe. But from myself, Dave Williams, and co-host Callum Stoneman.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.